Radio 1.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Derek, good afternoon. How are you?
Good at the moment.
Talk to me about day-to-day life in Gaza City, where you live. How easy is it, in the normal course of events, when there isn't an Israeli invasion going on, to get your basic day-to-day necessities?
Day-to-day living for the last year, in particular, since the tunnels, when the tunnels were all closed down, got very bad. I mean, you're talking about the prices of everyday commodities rose dramatically. Like a litre of petrol is now 14 times more expensive than it is in Egypt. And that may not sound much, but the thing is that you're talking about maybe 8 hours on a normal day, you would have 8 hours of electricity. So that means that you'd actually have to run generators for your house. So you actually have to buy petrol just to keep your electricity in your house. So you have, with the cost of just running costs for a house is dramatically increased. Food has nearly doubled in price.
How varied is your diet, Derek? Do you end up eating the same foodstuffs most of the time?
Yeah, falafel is a regular diet in Gaza. You're talking with it's a very basic food. It's normally chicken and rice or things like this. Very little beef. Beef is very expensive. You're talking about, we'd say, around 11, 12 euros a kilo for any kind of beef. And that would be minced beef. You're talking, we'd say, water. Water is the biggest problem at the moment, because 95% of the water in Gaza isn't fit for human consumption. So you actually have to get the water delivered to your house by tanker. And you're talking about 50 shekel a litre, which is around 10 euros. 10 euros for a ton of water. A ton of water might sound like a lot, but it will go very quickly when you're using it, we'd say, for washing. I mean, for washing, we'd say, your cutlery or your crockery, just drinking water, things like that. It does go fairly quickly. You would normally shower, though, in salty sewage water. Most of the water is salty sewage water that comes out of the taps. So that's what you actually end up washing in, and then you wash your clothes in that as well.
And yet, my impression from brief visits there in the past is that, by and large, most Gazans are quite happy with their lot, quite well-adjusted people, quite open and cheery. Obviously, they've got grievances, but they just get on with it.
Well, you remember that they are living under the longest siege in world history. This siege has now been going on for over 7 years. So after a while, you actually start to adapt. But I wouldn't say that they're happy with their lot. You're talking about a lot of people, they're very resilient. I would say that they're very resilient. They will make the best of what they have. And they are very generous people. I mean, I have gone to houses where they've actually physically had very little food, and yet they will offer you everything that they have, and they won't eat themselves. That's the generosity of these people.
Why did you decide to move there, and how long are you there now, Derek?
I'm there 2.5 years. Originally, I sailed first boat into Gaza in 2008. It was the first boat to reach Gaza in 41 years. And then brought in another 4 boats subsequently, and then another 2 boats. We've been arrested by the Israeli Navy for trying to bring in medical supplies.
And you were on that boat in which the Turkish activists were killed, weren't you, back in, what was it, five years ago?
Yeah, we were on that flotilla. Yeah, we were on the boat that left from Dundalk, the Rachel Corrie. So we were on that boat, and we got arrested as well, detained and sent to prison, then deported.
That's a snapshot of life in slightly more normal times. Now, you're not in Gaza at the moment, but talking to people back there, are you in any kind of communication with them?
Every day we're phoning different people just to even find out if they're still alive. I mean, the sad thing is I'm actually looking at the death list, looking for people that I know. I mean, and that's the sad thing. Like, the 4 children that were killed across the, that were killed on the beach. That's directly across the road from our house. And we knew these children. We knew the family well. They're a fishing family, one of the poorest families in Gaza. And they played on that beach every day of their lives, I think, because remember that Gaza is the size of Burn in County Clare. That's how small it is. And there is the Israelis state, I mean, that they're firing rockets from built-up areas. There is no place in Gaza that isn't built up. It is Gaza's complete. It's the third most densely populated area in the world.
So when the Israelis say that Hamas is sheltering behind the civilian population, that's really, you're saying, because the civilian population is just everywhere in Gaza. It would be very hard for Hamas to shelter behind them.
I'll give you an example. The Israelis imposed a 300-metre buffer zone along the Israeli border. And now this is where the agricultural land was. That 300 metres along the buffer zone constitutes 35% of the agricultural land of Gaza. That's how small you're talking. Mm. So, the people have nowhere to go. It's one of the only wars in the world where people have nowhere to run to. There is no refugees. You talked there about the Israelis said they dropped leaflets in Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia, which is in the north, and told people to evacuate the areas. The people left there and came down towards Gaza City. They are bombing Rafah and Han Yunus, which is in the south. And people left that area and moved towards Gaza City. And when everybody was in Gaza City, then that's when they actually started bombing Shajaiya. Shajaiya is one of the biggest areas in Gaza City. So they moved everybody into that area, and then they started bombing. This is why the casualty list in Shajaiya was so high. Because there's so many people, the displaced people, have moved in towards Gaza, living with either family or friends or things like this.
Derek, in their more private moments, when you're talking to Gazans, do they express any doubts about Hamas, or are they by and large supportive? Do you come across many people who just aren't supporters of Hamas and are quite happy to be so openly?
Oh yeah, if you look at the whole situation, Hamas was elected in 2006. Now, there was opposition to Hamas, like Fatah ran and they lost the elections. They didn't lose the elections because everybody was pro-Hamas. It was a protest vote against Fatah at the time. So you have a lot of Fatah people living there. You have PFLP, which is another political party. They voted for their people. There is a lot of different factions in Gaza. So they are all, they don't agree with Hamas.
Okay, but how many people would see the rocket strikes as a legitimate form of military protest action and a protest against the conditions that they're forced to live in?
A very, very large majority. Because it's not just Hamas that are firing the rockets. All parties are firing the rockets. Because they are resistance. On television and the media, they're called terrorists. In Gaza, they're called resistance. I mean, up to this, they didn't invade Israel. They see it as Israel invading Gaza. And they are resistance fighters. So all the parties will work together when an incursion like this happens. And all the parties, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, Fatah, all the parties will work together in resisting the Israelis. One thing, if you're watching the media, just watch the colours of the flags that are on the dead bodies. That will indicate what party the people were from. Like them four children were wrapped in yellow flags, meant they were a Fatah family. Mm-hmm. You will see other ones that are wrapped in green flags, that means they're Hamas family. If you see it black with yellow, it's Islamic Jihad. And if you see red, them wrapped in red, it means that they're Ali Mustafa, it's PFLP.
And Derek, knowing the families, knowing some of the people who have been killed, do you think that we back here in the West should be sharing those images of mutilated toddlers, of kids quite literally with their heads having been blown off? Because while on one side people argue, yeah, it's raised consciousness, it's told the world exactly what this kind of war is. But on the other hand, it's also, you know, these are some young people's most treasured items or possessions, belongings ever, and they're being disseminated around the world. Sometimes one would have thought in quite a voyeuristic way.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. You were like some of the pictures I don't think need to be shown on in public media. I understand why a lot of people show them is to show that the brutality that's there, but I think that if it's continuously shown over and over, I think people then become desensitized, and it doesn't help anymore. Mm-hmm. I think you don't need to show all the images, and like you says, they are people's children, they are people's loved ones. And to show these pictures, sometimes I don't think it helps. It may shock some people into action, but for me, I think the governments are the ones that need to take action.
Let me bring in Trevor Hogan as well, who's a part of the Free Gaza campaign, and as I suppose many people will know,
he was on one of the boats as well.
He was, and he's an ex rugby international too. Trevor, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. How are you?
What's your feeling about the sharing of these pictures now? I mean, it has undoubtedly and certainly in the United States changed or altered the playing pitch, but it is a bit insensitive, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I'd agree with Derek and yourself there to an extent. Some of the pictures are probably too graphic, and in a way, they can be nearly counterproductive in terms of trying to get the message across about what's happening and especially how many children are being killed. It's just absolutely so shocking to see the children being targeted. But I think there can be some images that are very useful. I mean, I tweeted a picture myself there of three of the Bakker family kids that Derek mentioned there when they're running on the beach trying to get away from the Israeli shelling. And it was just seconds before they got killed. And you could just see them running in full stride in their bright color t-shirts on a beach, literally just seconds earlier, been playing, trying to enjoy life in this criminal siege that they're undergoing. But that split image just captured something that kind of connects with everyone without being graphic, and it got a great response on Twitter. It was just taken from the news, but it's about getting the balance right and trying to reach out to people who, you know, we all know our basic humanity is within all of us, and when we see what's happening in Gaza, we should be able to relate to that and ask for it to stop.
You've been arguing that on this issue of balance, that basically we can't have it in this case, that even if Israel does have a right to defend itself against what is by now 2,000 rockets that have been launched in the last 2 weeks, balance just doesn't come into this conflict. There is a right and there is a wrong, and you're saying that Israel is wrong?
Yes, very much so. And I say even the line about Israel's acting in defence, that's where you're starting from the wrong point already, because Israel is actually the offender in this instance. It's instigated the violence on every occasion. It's a really important point to make as well. In 2012, when the ceasefire was brought in, within 24 hours, Israel broke that ceasefire and they killed a farmer in Khan Yunis, just in the south of Gaza Strip, and repeatedly broke the ceasefire subsequently up until this latest incursion. So Israel is not acting in self-defense whatsoever. The Palestinians in Gaza are the ones who are defending themselves. And it's kind of about, it's trying to change people's perspective a little bit, because I feel if you go down the road of there's two equal sides in this, then you don't recognize what's actually happening, and the sequence of events, the chronology is crucial. We need to be very, very strong on that, and that Israel is the one who's repeatedly broken the ceasefires. Hamas actually didn't fire one rocket for up to 5 months after that ceasefire, and apparently for even 18 months, even Netanyahu himself, in a moment of maybe brief honesty, actually admitted that. So it's about being strong on that, and then we call on Charlie Flanagan, our new foreign affairs.
But both of you, gentlemen, this is a question to both of you.
Can I come in for a second?
Hang on a second. You both know your Irish history here as well, and you know that what we used to call here in the case of the Troubles, whataboutery, only ends up having people rewinding the argument back to 800 years ago and Henry I, that it takes both sides to just say, stop, let's set aside the grievances, let's set aside the mistakes that have been made and try and engage positively.
Okay, sure, well, can I come in
Derek,
for a second
on
that?
Go, Derek.
There was The way this war actually started this time, there was three kids kidnapped in the West Bank. And when they were kidnapped, that's when Israel actually started shelling or bombing Gaza, was after they were kidnapped. Now, to give you an example of what that means, if three kids were kidnapped in Belfast and the British started bombing Cork, that's what you're actually talking about. There's no actually, there's no actual physical bridge between West Bank and Gaza, but they started bombing Gaza because they blamed the Gazans. I was actually there when that actually started, and all the resistance fighters in Gaza refused to fire rockets. They held their powder dry and they didn't do anything, and it just kept escalating and escalating and escalating until eventually they started firing rockets. And as soon as they started firing rockets, Israel then blanketed the media and says, we have started we're defending ourselves against attacks from Gaza. And that's when this war started.
Trevor?
And you also remember this, Abidur Lieberman was 10 days before the war started, told Netanyahu that if he didn't invade Gaza, he would pull away from the unity government and he would bring down the government. And then Netanyahu decided to go in.
So this is the leader of the minority party in the coalition?
Yes, correct. Yeah. He's the Minister for Foreign Affairs as well.
Trevor?
Yeah, I totally agree with Derek. I mean, this is the sequence of events that kind of needs to be made people aware of. I mean, I meet a lot of people who are eager to learn and are eager to know more about the situation. So it's vital that the message gets out there about this actually being instigated by. But you're right. In a way, we don't need to be pointing fingers and saying who started what. I think what the pictures and the figures speak for themselves. And it's just about being strong now, because I think the longer we try and maintain this, sitting on the fence on it and trying to ask for both sides to stop, the problem is that Hamas and the Palestinian people did stop. But what happens then is the siege continues. The devastation that Derek described brilliantly earlier is still in place. And while, you're dead right, the people are positive. They're so resilient. I remember when I met them, I couldn't get over their positivity and they're just so full of life and wanting to live. We met so many young kids there. I mean, that's the first thing you see when you get into Gaza, is like 50% of the population is children. And we were involved in meeting football teams, and they're just so warm and they're so bloody cute is the other thing. They're just so gentle and well-behaved, and they were doing all their little skills drills. And those kids now are the people I'm thinking of. I wouldn't have as close a contact as Derek does, but we don't know how they're getting on or what's happening to them, and that they're blackout at night time, they have no electricity. It's impossible to find out sometimes on the internet how these people are going. And you know, even aside from all the who started it, even though we know the sequence of events and we want to get that out there, whatever about that, why are you punishing all these children, all these women, all these innocent men? It's a collective punishment, and it's war crimes. And that's why I said in my piece, and I don't like saying, like, you know, you're either with us or you're against us, but sometimes when injustice is this bad and it's this clear-cut, you really need to be strong, you need to be vocal. And I think the more people that do that, and I think that across the world, so people in their thousands are showing that the pressure will come on Israel and their authorities, that they won't get away with this, and they can't keep doing it without people standing up and clearly saying that this is wrong.
Abraham,
the reason that Hamas are refusing the ceasefire at the moment is because the ceasefire is basically saying, you stop firing and we'll stop firing. Now, if they do that, it goes back to the same situation of the brutal siege that's there. Israel allowing 2,400 calories per day per person. It's basically enough to keep people alive. There's no medical supplies allowed in. So if you get sick, you die. There's no way out to get medical treatment because all the borders are closed. You're talking about...
I'm interested in getting a range of voices in here, 51551 or obviously 1850-715-815, but I have Abraham on the line. You were born in Gaza, but you're an Irish citizen now, Abraham, yeah?
I am indeed, yeah. I am, Philip, yeah.
And you're not a Hamas supporter. You say they have a lot to answer for hiding behind women and children.
No, they're not. No. Don't. That's bad interpretation. They're not hiding behind women and children. You see, the Gaza Strip have 1.8 million people in 365 square meters. The place is, it's like a can of sardine. So any firing or anything that Hamas is doing not from homes or schools, as being implied. They have to fight. They have to fight. They have to resist. They are under occupation. They are under siege. I can't understand what the world wants from them. I mean, all the talk is about Israel has the right to defend itself. What about the Palestinians? Have they no right? Are they not allowed to look for freedom, to fight for the right to live? It's absolutely, the media is absurd, actually, in the way it's portraying the situation.
How much of your family is still back there in Gaza?
Well, my father is 93 years old, and he's terrified to his wits with the situation that is. If a bomb doesn't kill him, heart attack will do. I have sisters, I have brother, I have nephews. I have a lot of family. Thank God none of them is hurt or killed so far. But that could change any hour, you know?
And how are they finding just subsisting? How are they managing to get their hands on basics like water and food?
Terribly. They're risking their life. I mean, people could leave their homes. I mean, even if they are in their homes, they're still getting bombed. So they are terrified to leave their homes to go and look for supplies or substance. There's nobody in the streets. There's nobody's moving in the Gaza Strip. And they're managing. I mean, you know, how do you say they're managing? You see that, okay, this is actually the situation in Gaza for the last 7 or 8 years since the blockade. Supplies are, I mean, I'm not on the conversation since long, but I heard somebody talking about 2,000 calories or whatever. You know, it's a prison. So what? They're supplying the people with enough just to survive. You know, but there's a lot of things that are missing from Gaza. Medicines, fuel, electricity. Mm-hmm.
Why have more members of your family not left like you did, Abraham? Is it another form of an act of resistance, just trying to stay in Gaza and get on with life?
Philip, I didn't leave by choice. I happened to be outside of Gaza in 1967 when the war started, and the Israelis wouldn't allow me to go back. I would have gone back willingly and delightedly, but I wasn't allowed to go back. The people from Gaza are not allowed to leave. And again, to leave, why to leave? Why should they leave? It's their country. It's their homes. It's their land. What are they supposed to do? Mass exodus? Like just leave it for the Zionists and the Israelis?
Philip, in 1948, the Palestinians left their houses thinking they would be returning. And they didn't. They've never returned. In 1967, they left their houses again thinking that they would be returning within a few days. And they haven't got their land back. So at this stage, the Palestinians are saying, we've had enough. You realize that Palestine is now down to 9% of its original size. And if they keep moving, there's going to be no Palestine. And
that's what's happening. Sorry, go on. Yeah, I mean, that's what's happening. All the colonizing in the West Bank, go back, as you're saying, is 9% of Palestine is left. The West Bank that's occupied in 1967, I don't know, there's a couple of 100 settlements. There's 500,000 Jewish people. You know what's ironic, actually? If you're a Jew, it doesn't matter if you're from Mars, you know? You have the right to go to Israel and live there. I was born in Palestine. I don't have the right to go and live there. I mean, it's an absolute irony. What they're looking for, it's ethnic cleansing. That's what it is.
Okay.
They want to clear the place from its indigenous inhabitants to replace it with Jewish people. If you're a Jew, I'm not against Jews. I have Jewish friends. It's Zionists that I'm against. It's the Zionist ideology that wants to replace indigenous population of Palestine by Jewish people from the four corners of the world that they have no right. You know, I mean, they talk about biblical stuff. That's all baloney, actually. That's all fables. That's all funny stories, you know?
Let me bring in Rosa here. Rosa, you're taking issue with me saying that in spite of everything, Gaza people are, well, it seems to me anyway, quite cheerful.
No, what you actually said was, hiya, Philip. You actually said that you had been there, and from your experience, that they were happy with their lot. And I think that...
Well, if I said happy with the lot, I was being clumsy in the way I said it, because what I meant is that in spite of everything, they are actually, well, in my experience, and we're going back to 2004 and 5, and the first Intifada in 2000, or the second Intifada, rather, and they seemed a remarkably cheerful people.
They're extraordinarily, I mean, they say in Palestine, you know, the Palestinians, we are in love with life. They're extraordinarily resilient. And I was in the West Bank, so I've never been in Gaza. I was in the West Bank in June. And it was an absolutely life-changing experience for me. I can't, there's nothing to compare it to. And the degree of hospitality, the degree of warmth was extraordinary. It was overwhelming. But also, coming into Tel Aviv and then traveling into Palestine, having to come back into Israel, even the simple, and this is in the West Bank, where there is a degree of, you know, there's more freedom to move. There still isn't freedom to move within the West Bank. I can't actually conceive of what it must be like within Gaza. Because even within the West Bank, having to go back into Israel or moving and around the West Bank, the occupied territories itself, you're potentially queuing for hours. People queuing for hours with children, old people. It's just extraordinary. You know, the thing that I find so intensely distressing is the concept that this is somehow a war, if you like, of two equal sides. It's just, Naomi Wolf is writing on Facebook this morning that she's getting a certain degree of hostility for her mourning or her support for the Gazans. And she's essentially saying that my family, half of my family was wiped out in the Holocaust. She says clearly, I stand with Gaza because I know genocide when I see it. This is genocide. It's ethnic cleansing. It's absolutely, it's just extraordinarily disturbing that there's any concept that there are two sides in this conflict. You know,
but Rosa, just because, Rosa, hang on a second, just because it's asymmetrical, just because it's very, very unequal or disproportionate, doesn't mean that we don't have to be careful with our use of words. And saying
that,
hang on a second.
I absolutely agree with that.
Then you can't use words like genocide, because genocide is a very, very distinctive thing.
It is genocide. It's ethnic cleansing.
Well, hang on a second. One voice. Guys, everybody's speaking at the same time here. So we'll let Rosa just pick up this point. You can call it murderous. You can call it barbaric. You can call it violent.
It is systematic. No, Philip, I'm sorry. I'm going to make that point. This is not my personal opinion.
No. One voice at one time. Rosa has got to respond to this point.
Okay. This is not my personal opinion. This is the opinion of some of the, and many people don't know this, some of the most clear and strong voices in the opposition to the occupation and the brutality and the apartheid in Palestine are themselves of Jewish origin. Norman Finkelstein, Noam Chomsky, Miko Peled, whose father was an Israeli general in the army, whose grandfather was a prominent Zionist, Naomi Wolf, Naomi Klein, all of these people are using this language. You must call a spade a spade. And I would really caution, and I mean this, Philip, I would caution the media and world leaders to be very, very careful about how they proceed from now on, because history will look back on this and say, oh my God, how did they let this happen? How did they let this happen? What I witnessed in the West Bank, and my voice is trembling now because it's absolutely, it was so horrifying. What I witnessed in the West Bank in Belian, I went up to visit the documentary filmmaker Imad Bernat that made that extraordinary documentary, Five Broken Cameras. What I actually saw there was as close to the written and cinematic portrayals and descriptions of how the Nazis treated the Jews as it is possible to get. And Jewish voices are now emerging globally to say, we recognise this. This is ethnic cleansing and this is genocide.
And I cut off Abraham. I cut off Abraham there. Let me bring him back in, because they're going to have to take a break sometime soon, folks. Abraham?
Okay. I entirely agree with what Rose is saying, really. I mean, why do we have to play on mince with words? It is genocide. It is ethnic cleansing. I mean, what the Israelis are doing, they want the whole land. They want the whole of Palestine. They want to clear this from the Palestinians, the indigenous people, and bring more Zionists or Jewish people, if you like. And I'm not saying Jewish
and all of that. You can say, Abraham, that Israel has territorial designs on Palestinian areas or parts of what should be Palestine, and you can say that they are unequal in their way that they prosecute their campaigns and so on. But if it was actual acts of genocide, as opposed to genocidal acts, and there is a difference, if it was actual acts of genocide, they would have been, by this stage, would they not, indicted before the International Criminal Court. One voice, guys. No, Rosa, you've spoken. Abraham, come on.
Israel have not abided by, I don't know, a couple of hundred United Nations resolutions.
True, but none of them have actually indicted them for genocide.
Well, I tell you, actually, to be honest with you, that should be a fault of the Palestinian Authority. They should have joined the International Human Rights Court, and they should have brought Israel to account in the International Court. I don't know. They're under pressure from the Americans, they're under pressure from the West.
All right, you know, folks, this is a conversation that's going to continue. I haven't taken a break since the programme has started. I have many, many more voices that I want to get in on it, but right now, let's just take a quick break.
1850-715-815.
Stephen, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
You were pro-Palestinian once upon a time, but not anymore.
Yeah, I was. When I was studying politics in Maynooth, I was very pro-Palestinian and very nationalist in my outlook on Northern Ireland as well. And then over the years and just studying getting into it, I've actually turned the other way now. And having worked with many Israelis as well, I've actually turned around the other way. And I truly believe Israel doesn't want any of this. And the gentleman there, they keep saying that the siege is a form of aggression, which it is. But Israel pulled out in 2005 and the siege didn't start until 2007. So there's an entire 2 years there where the border was open and stuff, goods were able to go, people were able to move, not completely freely, but it was open. And yet the rockets kept coming. And after 2 years of consistent rock and fire, then Israel put in the blockade. So, and also Egypt is also blockading Gaza, but there's absolutely not one rocket has ever gone into Egypt. So believe this is hatred. Hamas literally hate Israel and they hate the Jews, and this is what they're trying to achieve, and that's why they haven't declared an independent state, because they don't recognise these borders. They have the borders that were illegally occupied by Egypt in 1948, and they have what the international community said is going to be part of their state, and yet they still haven't declared an independent state.
But in the course of the last 18 months, the point that they're making is that Hamas had not been launching rockets and that all of the acts of aggression had been going one way, that the Israelis had been killing fishermen, farmers, and the odd isolated incident on an ongoing, continual basis.
No, to be honest, I don't believe Hamas have not been firing rockets, and if anybody wants to check it out, they can go to... The Setarot Media Centre keeps track of all the rockets that have been fired into Israel. And also, they've also captured several Hamas operatives trying to get through tunnels into Israel. So I don't see how they can say that they haven't done anything. And to be honest, if Hamas want the siege to end, then they need to just stop the rocket fire. And these ceasefires have proven that they do control the rocket fire that comes out of Gaza, even though they claim it's Islamic Jihad or it's other Islamic groups. The fact that humanitarian ceasefires have been largely adhered to shows that they actually do control the fire that comes out of Gaza. So I think it's just easy for them to blame other people.
So it's not a legitimate act of resistance in your mind?
No, to be honest, no, because Israel gave them the chance. They gave them 2 years before they left them with greenhouses, they left them with infrastructure. Israel provides all of their water and electricity. People forget this. Even when the rockets fly into Israel, Israel still provides all of their water, all of the electricity, all the humanitarian aid.
Let's talk to the man who's been living there for those 2 years. Bring Derek back in here again. Okay. Derek, what do you make of that?
Okay, I don't know where he's getting his information from, but I know that I accompany the fishermen and they actually have shot at me, never mind shooting at the Palestinians. So this thing about them... Now, hold on a minute. You're saying that, okay. You're saying that Islamic Jihad in 2012, they bombarded Gaza. Last year, they killed an Islamic Jihad leader, and there was over 100 rockets fired by Islamic Jihad, not Hamas. And the Israelis sat and talked with Islamic Jihad to broker a ceasefire. They refused to sit and talk with Hamas, and they brokered their ceasefire with Islamic Jihad. So you kind of turn around and say that. You also said that the Israelis pulled out in 2005 and the siege didn't start until 2007. Hamas were not in control of Gaza until 2007. The elections, it was after the elections, and Hamas won the elections, democratic elections, that was recognized by the European Union, by the Americans, by the Russians, and by all independent observers.
I don't deny that.
Let me finish, please. After Hamas won the elections is when Israel imposed the siege. Now, there was rockets firing before that, but it was not Hamas. That was coming from Fatah, from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade.
So don't try to dramatically increase. No, but they dramatically increased once Hamas took power. Dramatically, it was something like 50% increase when Hamas took power. And when they got into power, they executed all of the Fatah guys who were firing the rockets in the first place.
They didn't execute. There was a civil war inside Gaza, yes, and there was a lot of people killed on both sides. And Hamas, who had been elected, took the power that they had been elected to take. That is the situation that was on the ground.
Stephen,
there.
I think it's quite interesting that you used to have a pro-Palestinian point of view, and now you find yourself being much more sympathetic to the Israelis. What brought about that transformation? Tell me about the journey.
Basically, I had started studying college for a bit, and I got more and more into it then. And I had worked with Israelis for years then, and like, all guys who had been in the army, and some guys who are still in the army. And it genuinely just said, continuously, the same story I get from all of them, is that they don't want this, they're just sick and tired of it. And they have no interest, and all they want is to have, basically, just have peace. Like, that's why they pulled out, that's what they thought they were getting. That's why they signed a peace accord with Egypt, that's why they signed a peace accord with Jordan. They want peace with their neighbours, and they just cannot get it. And this is what I started to make sense of. And then the other conflicts in the world, I started to think, okay, this is part of a larger conflict. And we see what's happened in Syria, we see what happened in Egypt, what's happened in Nigeria. These guys all prescribe to the same ideologies. And Israel has been fighting this for 50, 60 years, and now it's starting to spread around the world.
Can I ask you one question? Can I just ask one question on this? What other country in the world refuses to state what its actual borders are? There's not one other country except Israel that refuses to state what its other borders are. And there's no other country in the world that is currently occupying land belonging to four other countries. The Shaba Farms in Lebanon, the Golan Heights in Syria, the Tehran Islands of Saudi Arabia, and most of Palestine. And then you wonder why your neighbours are upset.
No, well, they actually... Well, they... No. Basically... When Jordan invaded in 1948, the armistice line that was created, it was the Arab states that refused the border to be created. If you go back to the 1947 plan, the Israelis accepted that. And if you go forward to where Olmert made the offer in 2001, they accepted that, which is pretty much the current borders today. It was at the assistance of the Arab states that those borders did not become international borders. Israel has accepted those borders on multiple occasions, notably in 1947 and again in 1948. And yet,
they have refused to state what the borders are continuously. They never will state what the borders are. You ask any Israeli minister.
All right, Derek, you've made that point. Thank you very much. Abraham, can I bring you back in there for a second? Why did you choose Ireland when you had to leave Gaza?
Well, it was the choice. I met my wife in Spain. And we got married, and then I moved to Ireland. As I said, I was a refugee. I was a refugee several times. And as I explained to you, in 1967, I wasn't allowed to get back to Gaza. I was outside of Gaza. I was in Egypt studying, and I wasn't allowed to get back.
Have you been back since?
I have been back. I've been back for the last few years, several times. But, I mean, the process of getting me back, something that takes 2-3 months to apply for permission, and it has to be on medical grounds and humanitarian grounds. I'm not allowed to go and live in Gaza. Neither are my children. You know, I am from Palestine. I was born in Majdal, in Ashkelon, which is now is a total Israeli city. You know, they threw me and my family and my father, my grandfather, all my family for thousands of years. We are Palestinians. We were from Palestine. Why should we be thrown out to bring people from the Ukraine and Russia and America and plant them there in our place? It is ethnic cleansing.
Abraham, is Ireland a pro-Palestine country, or do you find... Is there sympathy for the Israeli point of view, like Stephen is trying to express now?
Well, there is actually sympathy for the Israelis, which is ironic, and it's really for Ireland and its history to see some Irish people like Stephen who's talking there. You know, how could you actually support Israel? How could you support the criminal acts that Israel is doing. On what ground? Like, you know, why would you stand against the Palestinians?
Well, you can be against acts of violence taken by either side, regardless of their justification.
Philip, the acts of violence are generated from the Israeli side. Occupying the Palestinian land, putting these refugees for the last 66 years in refugees camps and not giving them any rights, the right of return, the right of living, the right of freedom. I mean, Gaza is a prison. Why the world doesn't understand that? You know, talking about who was firing rockets. They are entitled to fire rockets. They're entitled to resist. What do you expect them to do? Lie down and die?
Stephen?
Well, if they stop firing rockets, I truly believe Israel would stop firing rockets. And they showed up because they pulled out every single Jew from Gaza. They did not leave one Jew. And Abbas has said the same thing. He says he will not leave one Israeli on Palestinian land when it becomes an independent state. Israel has never shown this level of intolerance.
They've located it by sea, land, and air. They've located it by sea, land, and air. It's not, you know, like, what? So they would do the Give me a minute. They withdrew the Israeli settlements from around Gaza and then blockaded Gaza, made it a prison. And what do you expect the people to do? Just sit there and die slowly?
But I believe if they stopped the rocket fire, it would stop. There's rocket fire every single day of the week.
The basis of it
is because Israel gave the whole Sinai Peninsula back to Egypt in exchange for peace, but they also signed a peace treaty with Jordan. You remember the West
what
Bank
peace?
Is based on an illegal occupation
Jordan
by Jordan.
Jordan is another country. Israel is not occupying Israel is occupying Palestine.
I'm saying that Israel has signed a peace treaty with a former enemy. This is what I'm trying to get across to you. That they have made efforts for peace. They pulled out of southern Lebanon as well, even though the other caller noted that they do occupy a small bit of it still. But they largely pulled out of Lebanon. They pulled out of Egypt. They pulled out of Jordan. They pulled out of Gaza. And all they get in return is rockets.
Stephen, isn't the point...
They've been negotiating peace for the last 50 years, okay? The deals that are done, the peace treaties that are done between Egypt and Israel or Jordan and Israel, is pressurized by the Americans. It's pressurized by the West. Okay? Israel is not occupying Egypt. They were occupying the Sinai Desert, and they will out of the Sinai Desert, and they signed a peace agreement.
Okay, do you know what, gentlemen? No surprise here, but unfortunately, I don't think we're going to solve the Middle
East. Can I just say one more thing?
Very briefly, Stephen. We've been at this for 45 minutes now.
Yeah, nobody's actually talking about the future, to be honest. And I think there's a serious problem, and people need to go and look it up, is that Hamas are educating their children to hate. And that's why there's absolutely no hope, I believe, unless they stop
Stephen,
educating their children.
Stephen, I'll tell you what, Stephen. Look up the cartoons on YouTube.
No.
I see what the Israelis are educating their children to do. They're training them worse than Hamas. The hate mail I get from Zionists and the lousy language and the profound language.
I'm sure, but they don't act on it. You're not under a physical threat. There was 200 Jews trapped in a synagogue in Paris because the crowd outside wanted to burn it down or throwing stones or trying to break in and attack
and
them.
There's 1.8 million people in a prison in Gaza. There's 1.8 million people imprisoned in Gaza. There is 1.5 million Palestinians in what's called Israel.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both very much. Abraham and Stephen, unfortunately, the conversation is just illustrating that the two sides are further apart than ever they were, but an illustrator, an enlightening conversation nonetheless. 2:30, we'll take a break.
1850-715-815. 1850-715-815.
Idan, when you were in the Israeli army, where did you end up serving?
I ended up serving in the Navy, in the Commando Navy, in the Commando Unit of the Navy for 4.5 years. And I found myself in Lebanon, I found myself in Gaza and in the West Bank.
And what view do you take of what you're seeing now?
Well, I was involved in several operations, and I lost 12 members of my unit in one night. and including my best friend. And I was, in a way, lucky not to be in that incident, but unfortunate to be one of the people that delivered the message of the death of my friend to his mother in a kibbutz in Israel.
And where was this that this happened, that you lost your best friend? What campaign was that?
Well, that was in 97. It was in Lebanon, in Ansaria, during an operation that was, as I see it, useless operation. Another thing, another one of these militant actions that are not necessary, as I see it today.
You mean militant action taken by the Israelis? That's not
taken by the Israelis, absolutely, yes. Just another... I would say action of violence that we can absolutely avoid, and we see it. You see how it happens every once and again, the same cycle.
And do you agree with the conversation where it was going earlier on that it is the occupation ultimately that is the source of the violence, or do Hamas have to accept some level of responsibility here?
Well, I absolutely agree that the occupation is the source of the violence and is the source for what is happening now. And, of course, Hamas will have to take responsibility and to accept the fact that Israel exists, and Israel should start to negotiate with Hamas and include Hamas in their negotiations with Mahmoud Abbas, and not to isolate Hamas.
But tell me, what do you think it is doing to the Israeli people being an occupying force?
Well, that's the hardest point here. That's one of the hardest stories, that the Israel has become much more hateful and fearful, and it corrupts the youth, it corrupts the population. You should see what's going on the network, on Facebook, on everywhere. People just full of hate, and for what? I'm sure that if those Israelis that are speaking the way they are speaking now were in the situation of the Palestinians, they would fight back. Nobody will manage to live his life in a situation that another nation is controlling every single thing that they are doing.
And when you express these kind of views to your fellow Israelis, what kind of a reaction do you get?
It's very complicated. It's very hard. Of course, people think that I'm a pro-Palestinian, that I'm a radical left, that I'm against Israel. Some of my friends from a movement that I'm heavily involved in called Combatants for Peace are basically demonstrating this moment in Tel Aviv and in Haifa and in Jerusalem, and they were basically beaten by extreme rights. But this is the price that we pay for our actions, because that's what we believe.
Okay, I wish you had called in earlier, but I would have had more time to talk to you, Idan, but unfortunately that is all the time that we have on today's programme. Yeah. Which was produced by Siobhan Hawk, and Gar Duffy was on sound. Thank you to Idan. Thank you to all of the other people who called in who I didn't get to today. Hopefully we'll get to talk to you tomorrow. Until the same time tomorrow, thank you very much for listening. Derek Mooney is up next. Good afternoon.